Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die, a semi-irregular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled When the Circus Leaves Town, and it's about performing and in particular show week and the kind of altered state of consciousness and living that comes with when you have a regular life and then you're a performer and then it's over. Our guest for this episode is someone who knows, I think, a little something about show week and performing and balancing work and life and whatnot. Miss Lori Hauser is here. You've been in theater since forever. Still alive. You know, say something about yourself.
I have been performing and producing and working in a lot of aspects of theater for 31 years now, actually.
Wow. 31 years. You're very old.
I am not very old. I just started really young, and I was lucky enough.
But then you started young, and then 31 years happened, so then became old.
Yeah. Well, I'm not still that old now.
You're pretty old. I mean, it's, yeah.
So
why didn't you get a real job? Why don't you, you know, be a good Republican suburban housewife type?
You know why?
Why?
One of the wonderful things about theater is that you learn always both sides of the story. You know, some plays you have to be the villain, you have to know the villain, you have to love the reason why the villain did something. Sometimes you have to be the good person and understand why the good person is good, and also understand that, you know, good people have their things too. So to walk out in life with that understanding and not choose what kind of day you want to live, you know, instead of putting yourself into a category. So that's why, you know, I don't really, you know, I never really wanted a real job. Like, my career is the art, my life, the way I live it. It has changed in the sense of my duties. When I became a mother, I became a mother. That's my job.
Only one, though, not like 20.
What? What do you mean?
Not like 20 kids, only one, right?
Only one, yeah. Only
so
one.
You didn't read that Pat Buchanan book, basically.
No. No.
Well, I think that leads up to my first thing I want to get through today is this question of, I think, yeah, the way a performer's mind, an actor's mind, has to be fluid.
Mm-hmm.
And how that affects the weird little community, the weird little tent city, refugee camp, whatever, that is every show.
Yeah.
You know, and even if you do, like, you're involved with a theater, say a college theater, a group of people, and there's a core nucleus of people who are always there, there always is this strange mood or attitude or weirdness that happens with, I think, every show, isn't it?
Well, compare it to small communities, like itty-bitty little communities, and how if you are an outsider of that community, you look upon them as if the way they act is odd, or you feel separate from them, you know. In theater, you know, just like any community, there's a process to become a functional member of that community.
Yeah.
And that is the audition. You walk into the audition. This is how you're going to say, here's what I can contribute to this little community.
Yeah.
And so once you're in, once you get your foot in the door, and you're all on the same team, that doesn't necessarily mean
your teammates.
Yeah.
This is true, which is, I mean, I think one of the things, and I think about my own distant ancient experience doing theater, which you were a part of, many, many, many years ago, as I'm old as well. And I think about how it helped me grow up faster, I think, in some ways than some of my contemporaries, because I had to be in a bunch of different environments.
Yes.
And sort of new people would show up, new challenges would show up, and it wouldn't be the same damn thing every, you know, semester we would do a show or in the summer or whatever. And how even though where I did theater was in a very isolated, small community place, I had a bunch of different experiences. And I think that's also maybe, yeah, you have to be someone else.
Yeah.
For a while, too. But then also in your, you know, when you pass the proscenium arch, there's people there. You know, there's a dressing room. There's a backstage. There's set pieces to be painted. You know, stuff like that. And how those people, your teammates, I guess, in a way, too, it's your social life.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It can be. It's various forms. It depends on how much you want to involve yourself in the culture of the show. When I was in my 20s, I wanted to be steeped, and I wanted to be in the center of that culture when I was a teen and when I was in my 20s.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I wanted to be in that. That was my social thing. But then we had the elders that even, and I couldn't understand, like the 30s and 40-somethings would come along and do theater with us. They would come, they'd rehearse, and they'd leave instantly. Yeah. You know, it wasn't like, to the bar, you know, or something.
Well, you think too, you know, because we're talking really about the theater at St. Francis in Loretto, PA.
I spent a very long time in that community.
Yes.
And that's where we met. So, yeah, yes. We could refer it, yeah.
And you think too, I mean, part of that... Ooh, I sneezed on. Sorry, if you're listening to earbuds, I just sneezed in your eardrums. But, and no, I'm not going to edit that out. Anyway, I think part of it, though, too, you think that environment being so small, St. Francis is still a small university, you know, the nucleus when I was there at theater was maybe 5 to 10 people, who were the people who'd show up every single time. It was an environment where if you did want to stick around and you did want to be the center or the thing, the focus or whatever, or a key component, it was, I want to say it was easy because there was a lot of hard work that went into it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you persevered long enough, you could become that person. You could become the belle of the ball.
Yeah.
You know, I started as a guy who I had one line in The Tempest.
Yeah.
And very quickly, you know, the cast parties were all at my house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's that transition. So that environment really bred the ability to do that and ability to become utterly immersed.
Yeah.
You know, and I think about, you know, the theater was at least was my social life there.
Yeah.
Which was this wholly separate orbit probably from everybody else I went to school with at the same time. We had very different undergraduate experiences, which is strange because that's a place that is very small and sells itself and prides itself on being this small thing. And we'll all be together in this. And it was like, they were all together in this. And then there was like 20 of us or 10 of us or 5 of us off in the corner somewhere, you know,
yeah.
In a basement, you know. And then once 1 week a semester, you know, we were on the stage, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? Because it was a small community, since we're talking about small communities, you could become the belle of the ball.
Yeah.
But this community was also based around a 4-year campus where every 4 years people, you know, every year
filtered out.
We
yes.
lost some, we got some new. So there was always a process of people coming and going. And it's in the real world, it's kind of like living in the small town, waiting for the elder to drop
to
off,
die.
So
you're
you could
right.
have that
you're
job.
Absolutely, right.
So you could finally
which
be
I think
the manager.
Was also part of the growth thing. I remember the first time I got a bigger role, it was like I got to do this now. Oh,
yeah.
Shit! You know, if I don't know all these lines and I'm not in some way decent at this act, this scene, this whole part of the thing is not going to work.
Yeah.
Oh, shit. You know, and yeah. This is scary, scary stuff. But I want to go back to this idea of the community, though, and how moods change depending on the production.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and how it's the group of people, it's the inside jokes, but isn't it also the subject matter?
Yes.
Of the show?
Yes. Now that depends. Luckily, at St. Francis, we were lucky enough to have a director that believed in... Every show had a meaning. Every show had
a
purpose.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, since then I've moved on to other theater companies that are like, oh, they're professional and this is their job. So, like, their job, they clock out and it's over.
Yeah.
But if you work in an environment where artists are creating something meaningful and not just putting together a show to put butts in the seats.
Yeah.
It's different because now you've invested your emotion, you've invested your sensitivities, you've invested your belief, and what you believe about the world can change.
Yeah.
Depending on the show.
That's
you learn
right.
something new. You learn a new idea, hopefully, or you reiterate an idea, depending on what vision your director... See, that's the thing, too. We are always led by the vision of the director. We have, of course, our own visions that we bring, but we meld them. We kind of meld them into the main. And, you know, of course, our director was a good director. And when you have a good director, they are capable of bringing everybody's visions into the show and melding them together into the main message, the main thing.
You know, as you're talking, as you're saying this, I'm just, for whatever reason, the mental image I got was meat grinder and making sausage.
Yeah.
I think, is the performance, you know, the intestinal casing?
Yes.
It's
it's the packaging. Selling the idea with the packaging.
Yeah. And I remember that because, you know, that was the thing about Kenny was, and he still does this. We went to the show on Halloween and you think the program is like, here's the cast, but by the way, this is some quotes, this is some ideas, this is what we're going for.
Yes.
And the long curtain speech.
Yeah.
About
make sure you get this point. There's the long.
Yes, and that in a way that was truly educational and truly a kind of pedagogy, even for the audience.
What's nice about that environment and that ideal, especially in a world where everybody's got an opinion, everybody wants something to happen in this world. Theater people can make shows and put them up in, you know, well, not always comfortable proscenium theaters, but you can put them up indoors and people will come see them and there's a message to be said.
Yeah.
Whereas other people who want to change the world or have an ideal will stand out on a street corner freezing, will get tear gassed, will get abused because they have an opinion.
Yeah.
We open the doors and we charge people.
Yeah.
And we entertain them.
Yeah.
And in the middle of that entertainment, we say something, and that we get to stay warm, dry, well-dressed, we get makeup, and we get to show off, and we don't have to be picketers, and we don't have to be beat up, because it's getting dangerous. It's dangerous out there, but doing dangerous theater isn't like an audience member is going to jump up and punch you in the face. It hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
I've been approached by people that have been offended by the messages, generally conservative people, because, we tend to promote liberal lifestyles in a sense of, you know, be who you are, live your life, that kind of thing.
Well, and I think part of that also is you have to be other people. You have to see how other people live and figure it out, and it's very hard to see the world in black and white after you've been through that process.
Yeah, well, if you've been lucky enough to play a complete jackass on stage, like somebody you want to hate.
Yes.
You, as the actor, are not allowed to hate that character, because if you hate that character, it doesn't happen. The magic does not happen for the audience. They don't get it.
Well, that's like they had, I think, what cable network? It might have been Bravo had the American Film Institute Top 100 Villains.
Yeah.
And they did Annie Wilkes, the Kathy Bates character from Misery.
I love her.
And the interview, and it was great because they spliced it, and there were all these people, evil, evil, oh my gosh, she's so scary. And, you know, Kathy Bates was like, she just gets a little carried away, she loves what she loves. And then the last clip from the cheesy clip show, she said, try as hard as you can, I will not say anything bad about Annie Wilkes.
Right.
And I think that was the epitome of that mindset. But I do want to go back.
Okay.
I do want to go back for a second, because I mean, we're not Rev and Billy. We're not doing street theater, which, by the way, it's late November. It's time, everybody, to watch What Would Jesus Buy? His documentary about his street theater and his tour. It's amazing. Yeah, everybody should watch it. But I think there is something to be said, though, about doing theater. And even though you're comfortable and it's dry, usually, about the willingness It is a risk, though, isn't it? And isn't there a risk of humiliation? There's a risk of failure. And there also is a very real risk of putting your body, clothed or not, kind of nakedly out there.
Yeah.
You know, that you're going to stand on a stage and a bunch of people are going to look at you. And they're going to look at your gut, and they're going to look at your ass, and they're going to look at your facial expressions. And that takes, I think, some guts.
Well,
you're aware of, I think, that risk of humiliation. It's that Nietzschean sort of man on a wire thing.
Yeah.
Whenever you're up there, the possibility of falling completely off and tumbling into hell is, or the abyss or whatever, is very real.
Yes.
I mean, I had one, and it still haunts me, I had one incident on stage where I completely blanked, and I was the lead in the show. I completely, for a split second, I had absolutely no idea what was next.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost went into that panic mode, which then you immediately will forget the rest of the script.
Everything's gone, yeah.
Everything's gone. And it just so happened that the person next to me started doing a motion, which was the cue for the next line. I was supposed to observe, oh, hey, Mr. Putnam's doing that. And so I said, oh, hey, Mr. Putnam, there's Mr. Putnam. And it was the best line I think I've ever delivered because it was the most true. Because I was surprised, too, that that was happening. And it happened to be the line at the same time. So I think there still is a tremendous amount of risk, right?
Yeah.
And stress for that. And how does that affect that little tent community when, you know, people are going to show up and they're going to pay money and they're going to, yes, they'll be in a nice seated space, but they're going to be looking at you. And how is that part of the mood of that community? I think that's important, right?
Yeah.
Because a little fear is a good thing, too.
Oh, yeah. No, it's, and I feel that putting yourself out there like that helps build self-confidence.
Absolutely.
Because it teaches you that, okay, well, you might fall off the stage, but it's not death, blood, or fire. Well, yeah. It might be blood. There might be blood. There might be death. But, yeah. You know, you might trip over, you might forget a line. You know, anything could go wrong at any point in time. But once you have adopted that mindset on stage, you can adopt that mindset out in the real world. Anything can happen at any point in time. But regardless of that, the answer that you want, it's not the answer that you want, but what...
Well, the answer I'm going to get.
What the answer you're going to get as far as the fear and how it goes on backstage. Everything that people believe about what happens backstage is most likely true. Yes, emotions are high. Mm-hmm. If you have a good director... their emotions are way higher than yours, so they're going to manhandle you into behaving yourselves.
Yeah, that was Kenny, yeah.
because they don't care if you hate them or not. They want a good show.
Yeah.
But they also want to see you have a good show.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, that was Kenny, yeah.
Part of the challenge is, like in daily life, putting your intense energy and fear and wonderment and worry aside to make something great happen. Yeah. And that's where the difficulty happens. Some people, everybody has their own coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Some people go over their lines 100 times before they walk out on stage.
Yeah.
Some people would rather go out and smoke 10 cigarettes. Everybody has a ritual. Everybody establishes a religion, a personal religion backstage to get through the week. Get along with people. Stay out of everybody's way. There are always explosions. Somebody blows up.
Yeah.
If you are lucky, it is your leader that loses it first to put you all in your place.
This is very true.
If you are unlucky, you've got a weak director or you've got somebody that just wants to be kind, compassionate, and wonderful. And just lets the cast cannibalize all the work.
Well, yeah.
Because they're too busy worried about their personal poop.
Yeah. Which brings to mind another thing that you mentioned, and we have to, I think, explore, is the ritualistic quality of theater. You know, you think you do a show, and again, maybe this is my reference of only working with Kenny. 6 o'clock every night is the same thing.
Yes.
When you do a show, and 2 weeks before move in is the same thing, and this is the same thing, and there are all of these rituals, so it is sort of like a mass.
And it
you know,
makes...
you know when to stand up, you know when to sit down, you know.
Just like yeah. the idea of religion and God yeah. make religious people feel safe.
Yeah, because it's the same.
The ritual
thing
of theater
every Sunday, yeah.
gives you that idea of safety. You're not really.
Yeah.
But doing the ritual is something to back up the idea that you are safe.
Yeah.
That you will be okay.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of fear, in the midst of missed
chaos.
Cues, in the midst of crew person not being in right place, in the midst of
line
when you
flub.
Have some, you know, people that don't do theater don't realize that when you're doing a show and even like a two-person cast, you've still got people running cues, you've still got people backstage
yeah.
trying to do all kinds of stuff, and at any point in time, any one of those people can drop the ball. So you do your ritual. You perform your ritual before the show.
Your leap of faith, yeah.
Before you
yeah.
commit the ritual of theater.
Yeah. Yeah, which is... Absolutely. Absolutely. So, can we talk, though, now about this issue of the different moods that different shows bring? You know, because there's...
Sure.
There's two great, supposedly cursed shows. There's the Scottish Tragedy, and I don't want to get into that. But the other one is Brigadoon. And Brigadoon, because there's no villain.
Yeah.
And supposedly, if you do, that's part of theater lore. The fact that there is this lore.
Yeah.
You know.
I think reason that that Brigadoon is cursed, as far as not having a villain, you are showing a very unbalanced world. Just like the Scottish Tragedy is...
Notice we're not saying it by name.
I know! Can we tell the audience it's Macbeth?
Oh, you're gonna die today. That
yeah.
sucks.
Well, this is the name of the show.
You're all gonna die. That would be weird.
But we're not in a theater.
Day.
I mean, that's
the last
how
day she was alive. We recorded a podcast
about.
It wasn't
yeah.
that good, but it's her final legacy.
Just make sure my daughter knew I loved her.
well, it's now recorded. So
yeah,
there you
it's
go.
On it's on the air. So you know, when you're doing Macbeth, you're showing everybody that the world is entirely evil. Everybody's evil, evil, evil. So there's an unbalance.
Yeah.
And so when you do Brigadoon, you're like, oh, it's all fabulous and light, we're all no, that's a lie, too. Guess
yeah.
what? You gotta have balance. People that go to see Brigadoon, I'll say it out loud. I enjoy Macbeth more than I do Brigadoon.
There you go, yeah.
Does that say something about me? Yeah, probably.
Absolutely.
I don't care. What it says about your audience, the people that come to see Brigadoon, you know, and they just, oh, I could watch it 100 times, and I'm like, you buy that story, don't you? You
yeah.
really think the world's like that, don't
well,
you?
Well, it's part of that, yeah, it's part of that way you're sharing the fantasy with other people.
Right.
You get to live that world for a while, they get to live it vicariously through you.
Right.
But I think there's an important thing when you're talking about being out of balance. I think a common experience that we had together, and we probably shouldn't say any names, but of people, right?
Right, no,
but
no
the
names.
The most unbalanced show I think I was ever involved in, which was the weirdest show, was when we were in Winnie the Pooh together.
Yeah.
And I was...
Notice the evil laugh, by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, I was Tigger, and you were Piglet. We could say that.
Yes.
But... You think, because there's a lot of things, I think one of them, because that show was so unbalanced, I mean, the set was children's toys.
Yeah.
I was Tigger, for crying out loud.
It was a brilliant idea. I mean,
it was a brilliant idea. It was a great show.
It was wonderful.
It was wonderful. But you think, that show, a couple things I remember about that show. One was, that was the show where I think even the high school kids working with us, talk about backstage swearing. I mean, you know what I mean? You like, you're Piglet, you're Kanga, you're one of the rabbits, you're Christopher Robin, and then you go to the back, fuck, fuck, mother, fuck, 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 you know? That was one thing. The other thing is, hey, it was the summer. It was weird as a cast, because you're with people, and you're with, you know, it's like a team, but then there's people of the other gender or of your gender or whatever, that you're together, and not saying that people who are on the football team together probably don't end up sleeping with each other sometimes. But in theater, you get this whole mix of things. And so the hookups for that show, and we always would, in the rumors, be like, did you hear what?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you hear what Christopher, you know? And oh my God, and Kanga, you know? And like, whatever, right? And you had that element. And we wouldn't say people by their names. Like, I think they hooked up after we were on the diner. It was always so-and-so after so-and-so, which was, which again, I think was we had to be so nice and so pleasant and so wonderful.
Yes, this wonderful children's world, and we're all
we're
being
wonderful
real
children's
human
world.
Beings
yes,
backstage.
And then as soon as that was over, it was you know, it was like people, and I think some of it was a fiction, I think in some ways.
Yeah.
You know, some of it was, but I think we were just so embellishing, you know. You know, those people
maybe
might have just, you know, held hands and walked around Walmart together and said goodnight, you know. But it was, I think we needed that evil
we needed
in our
the
lives.
Well, and I can't even say it to you, it's the human story.
Yeah.
You know, especially when you're out there and you're just like, oh, kids, the world is Winnie the Pooh. And then you go backstage, like, we're all human beings.
Yeah.
So I think we, you know, and this can happen backstage, we establish the, you know, the fact as people that we're human beings and we commit human acts, not
yeah.
necessarily evil, not necessarily, you know, completely awful, but, you know, we embellish. We embellish to make, you know, to ward off
yeah.
what we're doing out on stage.
Yeah. And of course, in that, you know, we did have a cast member have a nervous breakdown, total serious nervous breakdown during that show.
I know, and you know, some people I just can't get them to buy that story. I'm glad we're recording this.
Yeah, no, I mean, and that was downright scary.
It was pretty scary.
Very scary.
You know, when you're fearless and fabulous and wonderful, director and his wife show up shaking. You remember?
Yeah.
At your house.
Yeah, they did.
You know, it just got scary.
Yeah.
And we just had
well, it
to
happened
pick
to us before
up.
That, because when the breakdown was happening, we went up to the director's wife, and we're just like, is there anything we can do? She's like, no, you guys can all leave.
And Danelle said, we were still
scared.
Children.
Yes.
So they were being parental.
They were being
send
parental.
The children
well,
home.
Yeah. But what happened was, is Danelle said to Bonnie, well, I'm scared. And she said, I'm scared too.
Right.
And that's when I knew this just wasn't normal backstage drama. This wasn't just the stress of it. It wasn't the, you know, everybody being evil, sadistic American death youth. But that was...
But you
want to
know...
The universe was broken then.
You know what the good news is?
What?
That's not the only environment... or not the only show that's happened. I've done
yeah.
other shows where people have snapped.
Yes.
But then, at the same time, we've also been in the real world together when
people
have
snapped. Yeah.
People snap.
This is true. we're running a bit short on time, so I do want to tell the story, and maybe if you can respond to this, and then we'll get to the bottom five. That inspired this podcast was one of my first shows where I was a leader. And, you know, I was expected to do Strike, which was taking down the set, and cast party organization, and all that stuff. And I remember the show was over. We did Strike. We took the set down. We put everything away. The circus had truly left town. And I remember I was in a friend's car, and we all went out to eat. And then I got back in the car, and everything was now officially over. They were going to drop me at my house, and it was done. And I just remember the absurdity. There was a pizza place nearby, and some woman was walking out with two pizzas. And I was just like, wow, people are still getting pizza out there. And that, in a weird way, that blew my mind. That blew my mind! Because I was like, that the world has gone on. Without me, without us.
Post-show depression.
But it was just like the city evaporates.
Yeah.
And everybody scatters, and it's so over, it's like it never happened.
Yeah. And then, you know, some people still try to hang on. You know? Some people try to remake those situations again, but once that moment is gone, it's gone, and you have to go. It's like the artist that paints the canvas and then says, okay, and lights it on fire.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, theater is so intense in that way, because we always know we're going to set that canvas on fire at the end.
And on that happy note, it's now time for the bottom five.
All right.
The bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic and or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Got to ask this one. Reincarnation is real, and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness. What kind of disease would you be?
The plague.
You want to be the plague?
I want to be the plague.
You want to be the plague?
The plague.
Historically, plague.
Yeah. Well, we have the
cure for the plague. Because the plague's not doing...
Yeah, the plague's not doing anything. I guess we have to pick a modern disease. I don't really know what modern...
Ebola? Ebola's still up and coming.
Yeah?
Ebola has a 90% fatality rate.
Wow.
People bleed out of their eyeballs. Men bleed out of their nipples.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I don't think I know enough about modern diseases. Probably because I ignore it.
Yeah.
It's probably in our water.
So... All right, next question. Question two. What is the strangest injury you have ever suffered?
Ha! Strangest injury I have ever suffered. I have... I have a scar on my ankle because I ended up... I don't even know how it happened. It was like one of those moments, like a bunch of hot water ended up on my foot. I flew back. I ripped off my shoe and my sock. And the reason what made this injury strange is the way everybody else reacted to it. I'm yelling at them, telling them to get me a bucket of water and some ice, and everybody's just standing there.
Mm.
You know, it's just that moment of like, this is
really
odd.
Where did it happen?
Doesn't anybody know? Am I allowed to say it as a company? Are we going to... Or is it coffee?
No, it's not the company. Let's just say...
It was, of course, food service. It was a bagel
shop.
Oh, it was
a food service. Okay, bagel shop.
It was a bagel shop. And, you know, and what made it strange is that nobody else knew how to react, but the person that it happened to, you know.
Well, they probably didn't do that. Question three. What is your most irrational pet peeve?
My most irrational pet peeve.
Thing that sets you off that really shouldn't, but damn it, why are you doing this? And the one I keep saying is when people juxtapose scratch and itch, that sends me to some reason, some stupid red line anger. I had a scratch, so I itched it. When people say that, I just... Though confessing it on this podcast repeatedly has diminished that a bit, but yeah.
I'm showing you my most irrational pet peeve.
What is it?
If I talk to you, I need you to talk back at me.
Oh, there we go. Nice.
That bothers me. When I say something to somebody, I don't want their silence. I want them to say, yes, no, give me some, you know, give me something. Don't just be silent and sit there and look at me. Like, give me something. Show me that you exist in there.
You see. And in the world of radio, we just call that dead air.
Right.
Next, what is the strangest item you have eaten and or found in your stool? The look on your face, but it's a podcast.
I know. That's why I'm in theater. You got to see me. I'll admit, strings.
Strings?
You ever get a string? You ever see a string?
No.
Yeah.
Sure it's not a tapeworm?
No, it wasn't a tapeworm. I mean, it's not that I picked it apart or anything, it was a string.
Oh, okay, string. All right. Final question, bottom five. And this is the last, this is the fifth question of the bottom five. And this is the bad porno plot question. If you had access to a time machine and the only purpose and the only thing you could use that time machine for was to go back and to have sex with a historical figure, who would that figure be, if you could? If you had access to time machine and you showed up at so-and-so's doorstep and say, we got to do it for the sake of humanity or something, who would it be?
I think it would be Anne Boleyn.
Anne Boleyn, nice one.
Because somebody needed to let that woman know that she was okay.
Great, great answer. Great answer. Well, I think that's about it. Considering how long it took for this episode to happen, I have to say our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, especially old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast. And we're all going to die on Facebook and Google+. Thanks, Lori, for doing this on short notice. And
it's awesome.
It was
Thank
fun,
you.
Yeah. And thanks to Brett Zorich, as always, for the lovely theme music. Later, meets.